Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Siegel, Judge Bradpo, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are, for the sake of the audio record and those perhaps watching on a live stream, I'll mention that we are sitting today in Rochester, Minnesota at the Olmsted County Courthouse. Thanks to the hospitality of State Court Administration here. We appreciate very much the time and effort that they make to make it possible for us to drive to this part of Minnesota to hear cases arising from the third district. We have four cases on our oral argument calendar today, and we are ready for the first one. I will call that case. It's case number A23-1663, State of Minnesota versus Raymundo Gonzalez. Counsel, I think you both are familiar with our procedures and protocols. Counsel for appellant, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument. And we have a time clock, I think. I think it's visible to everyone.
Right here, I think.
And so you'll see that the time on that time clock, and then when the time is up, it'll shriek with a very loud noise that might alarm you. So I'm giving you
and
one.
I will too.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. My name is Eva Wales, and I represent the appellant Raymundo Gonzalez in this matter. Mr. Gonzalez was convicted following a jury trial, and he raises three issues in his brief to this court. But this morning, I would like to focus on the second issue, which is whether the prosecutor's pervasive misconduct deprived Gonzalez of a fair trial. During trial, the prosecutor engaged in numerous acts of misconduct. The most repeated and egregious misconduct occurred throughout the prosecutor's closing argument, in which he littered his speech with invitations to the jury to align themselves with him and implications of his alignment with them. He insinuated that he and the jury were part of a group from which Mr. Gonzalez, the defendant, was excluded. And that is conduct which has been considered and prohibited by our state Supreme Court in State versus Mayhorn in 2006. A total of 37 times, which I listed in my brief, the opponent's brief, he used some sort of variation of a "we know" statement, something like "we know, we have no doubt, we think, we do, we know," and so on. And I won't read all of those, as you can see those in my brief. Those statements occur on about 10 out of 21 transcript pages of the closing argument. So about half of the transcript pages by my count. And starting early, starting within the first couple paragraphs, continuing throughout that closing argument. This was improper, this was misconduct, and this is behavior repeated by this prosecutor and in this county by his office, and it's grounds for reversal.
Ms. Wales, what if the prosecutor had used the pronoun one, O-N-E, to say, you know, one knows from listening to the testimony, or one can take this away from this exhibit, and you know, one should have no doubt about the credibility of the witness, and so on. Would that be proper?
That would certainly have been a better word choice. That would more closely resemble, I think, an argument, potentially a vigorous argument. I don't think it's necessarily proper in every instance. I think it would depend on how that was used and whether it also continued to exclude Mr. Gonzalez from that sort of alignment.
Isn't that sort of essentially what was happening here? I mean, the use of "we" was kind of a figure of speech, or it's a way of choosing a different pronoun.
But
was it really used in a way where the prosecutor was it used in place of "you and I," or, you know, "all of you and I know such and such"?
Yes, I think it was. And especially as we look at the pervasiveness of it, it was the word we. It wasn't you. It wasn't one. It was we know. And in fact, the respondent conceded in his brief, and I counted in the respondent's brief at least 10 instances that he conceded were misconduct, were the wrong word choice, and were improper alignment. So, so appellant contends that we're looking at a minimum of 10 instances of misconduct agreed on by respondent, going up to 37 instances of that word. There are other instances or other types of misconduct that I mentioned in my brief. But when we're looking at this, they were not objected to. So we look at this under the, consider this under the modified plain error test outlined in state.
Were there some instances where the use of the word we had the meaning everyone in the courtroom knows, or everyone in the courtroom can see, everyone in the courtroom heard this testimony?
Yes, there were a few of those instances, and I'm not contending that that was incorrect. For example, there was one statement the prosecutor said something like, we heard a phone call between Mr. Gonzalez and a detective. And that's describing evidence that everyone in the courtroom heard. So I'm not contending that that's misconduct. And I think there were a few of those. But when the prosecutor alleged, we know, we have no doubt, all these instances, we think this, that is misconduct. So I agree that there are cases in which, or situations in which the prosecutor can say, well, we heard this, we saw Mr. So-and-so or whoever come in and testify. And yes, that's something that everyone in the courtroom saw and heard. But most of the situations in which he used the word we were improper. I wanted to look at or focus on prongs 3 and 4 of that modified plain error test, given that respondent conceded some of the misconduct. Happy to answer about prongs 1 and 2 as well. But if we look at the substantial rights analysis and then the fourth prong, first we can consider how many statements, how pervasive they were. And I've touched on that. I think that there were quite a few, at least 10 going up to, I would argue, 37 we statements throughout the closing argument. We also consider the strength of the evidence in the case at hand. I would compare this case to the Supreme Court's case of State versus Portillo, decided late last year in 2023. There are striking similarities, I think, in the fact pattern and how the evidence and how the trial came in. And that was a case in which the Supreme Court said there was prosecutorial misconduct that did affect substantial rights and then required reversal. And the similarities in these cases are they were both second degree crim sex cases. Both of them went to trial about 10 years after the conduct was alleged to have happened. So we're talking about a great distance in time. There were child victims, alleged child victims, who were testifying then 10 years later. In that case, I think one thing that makes appellant's case a little bit stronger than Portillo is the fact that it's very difficult to respond for the defense attorney to respond to this type of misconduct. For one thing, the misconduct was not objected to, so it's a little illogical if the defense attorney in their closing argument says, well, you heard the prosecutor say we, it was not objected to. That's kind of the objection. But it's also a legal type of misconduct, as opposed to in Portillo, it was a misstatement of the presumption of innocence. And so so that, at least as far as kind of an instruction, that's easier to respond to say, here's the correct presumption of innocence. And in fact, the Supreme Court considered in Portillo the district court's instruction that was given after rebuttal argument as well. And there was no such occurrence in this case and in this type of misconduct. So so we contend that Mr. Gonzalez's substantial rights were affected, and the state needs to show that they were not. I don't think the state can meet that that burden. If we go on then to the fourth prong, which is whether the reviewing court should address this error to ensure the fairness and integrity of judicial proceedings. I would argue absolutely yes. the state cannot show, has failed to show, that there is a reasonable likelihood that these misstatements did not affect the jury's verdict. This type of alignment kind of strikes at the heart of the fair process in which the prosecutor is a minister of justice, a vigorous advocate as well as the minister of justice. And I think it's important, and I do want to mention that and through my office, we've seen this type of misconduct come out of Olmsted County various times. There was an unpublished, non-presidential case from April of this year, State versus Clement, in which this court did find that the prosecutor's "we know" statement in closing argument was misconduct. Eventually, this court said it did not affect the substantial rights because it was an isolated remark and based on the evidence. Differently here, we don't have an isolated remark. We have many remarks. There's also a pending case, State versus Horton, in which my office is contending that more "we know" statements occurred that were prejudicial. And so I think it's important, if this is a common sort of a practice that needs to be addressed, it's statewide, but certainly coming out of this office. And we think that that does go to the fairness and integrity of the judicial system as well, and the judicial system, particularly within this county.
So, counsel, I'd like to back up a little bit and talk a bit more about the strength of the evidence, that prong.
Sure.
So this is a case where, and you can correct me, it's my impression that the primary defense was the challenge by the appellant that the young woman here had misidentified him. He wasn't the person that had abused her. So not saying that the charges were fabricated, but that it wasn't him, right? And am I right about that? And so I'm just trying to understand how your focus on the "we" statements and our evaluation of that, if we were to agree with you up to this point, how that factors in with our analysis of the strength of the evidence, given the theme that was raised at trial. It doesn't seem to me that the "we" statements directly pertain to the primary defense in the case. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, but okay. And the appellant's position is that yes, that's incorrect. The "we" statements go throughout, and so I think they touch on it like Swiss cheese. They're holes throughout every aspect of the argument. I agree that the identity was certainly a theme at trial, mm-hmm. and there were a few witnesses that the state called in to get at that issue of identity. I wouldn't go so far as to say that that Mr. Gonzalez conceded that abuse happened.
And I didn't mean to imply that.
Sure.
Just that was the primary theme, certainly in the closing arguments of the defense. And in terms of understanding the the prejudice prong here.
Yes.
And I appreciate that burden, again, if we agree with your analysis, shifts over to the state. But I'm missing that link, and maybe you could point out a "we" statement or two that would help me understand.
Sure, and I can try to go to my
list. It was just my question, and
yeah.
I don't mean to derail your argument if you want to get on to something else.
Oh no, yeah. I think obviously that's a fair question. Well, first of all, I think the "we" statements kind of set the tone of me and my office my office and I have looked into this case, and trust us, we know what to do, and we know that it's him. We know we worry about this. Why do we worry about identity? Let me find my lengthier list. And I think respondent in his brief actually has the paragraphs. I do see one in which he says, we know the identity, we have this phone call, we have the photo, we have Facebook. I know the photo mm-hmm. and Facebook, we're going to things about the identity. We have no doubt, we have the right person, we have more. I think that was when he said, we have more related to identity. We have Facebook, we have the photo, we have Aunt Rosa, we have this phone call. So I think that those arguments did specifically go to identity as well as the more general that's how we know, and if we didn't know, more general alignments as well.
Thank you.
Sure, you're welcome. He did also, as far as other types of misconduct that I brought up, and I'll just touch on that based on the question about identity. I contend that there was some improper vouching as well, in which the complainant, the alleged victim testified testified regarding how he looked, and the prosecutor in his closing argument said, she said at the time, she said he was mustachioed. He wasn't as then, he wasn't as now, and believe her, that sort of thing. So I think he was saying believe her and vouching related to the, related to her testimony, related to what to the looks of the defendant, which went to the identity prong as well.
Ms. Wales, in your brief, kind of back to the first issue about the word we, you cite the Mahorn case. I think Mahorn there's a lot of evidence that the prosecutor had intentionally tried to draw a difference between the jury and the defendants based upon either race, ethnicity, culture, as well as lifestyle, and so on. And certainly that was one of the things, I think, driving that decision. Are you suggesting there's anything like that in this case?
No, I think the Mahorn conduct was more egregious as far as drawing that distinction between race, class, gang activity. And here it's more of an alignment, I guess, generally speaking, but not kind of differentiating Mr. Gonzalez based on his race or his economic status, something like that.
Okay,
I agree
you.
With that. Mm-hmm. I believe that the other issues were adequately briefed. And if there are no more questions, I will save any other comments for rebuttal.
I have maybe one question, if I may, about the third issue, the so-called restitution. If we agree with you that there was an error, what do you believe is the proper remedy?
Well, the relief before this court is to vacate the restitution order. That's the relief that we're asking for. It was an improper restitution order. Illegal restitution order, so this court should vacate, and that's what we're asking, the relief.
And is there a separate order embodying the restitution decision, or is there just a line in the warrant of commitment?
Just a line in the warrant of commitment. There was an oral order, and it's within the sentencing order warrant of commitment. No separate order.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent may approach. You may, when you're ready, identify yourself and your clients, and then you may begin your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. What I'd like to accomplish in the limited time before this court is I'd like to just touch very briefly on the issue three of the disbursements, very briefly. I'd like to make just brief comment on the second issue that is relating to the closing argument. But what I'd really like to do is spend the bulk of my time talking about State versus Ness and how it is a factual outlier that doesn't apply to this case. And I think that's the issue to me that's the most interesting, not just as applies to this case, but more broadly. Disbursements. The case that appellants cited in their brief, the one I wish I would have spent more time talking about, is State versus Kujak. It's cited on page 32 of the appellant's brief. There was a parenthetical in the appellant's brief that correctly states that the directing of payment of restitution to a drug task force is inappropriate. That's true because they're not really a victim. But what this court went on to say in this published decision, though, was that the characterization of this as restitution was simply an inadvertent technical error, and that such an order was clearly permissible under Minnesota Statute 631.48. I think that just resolves this issue squarely on its face. This was just an inadvertent technical mischaracterization of this as restitution, when from the outset, this is just a clearly permissible disbursement. And that's, I briefed it. That's all I really care to say unless the court has any questions about that.
Did you cite Kujak? I'm sorry.
I didn't, but the appellant did.
And so, and was there any remedy provided in Kujak or simply affirmance or what was it?
Therefore, we affirm that portion of the district court's order. So the this court just on its face affirmed the distribution, even though it was mislabeled as arrested.
Without modifying it in any way?
Without remanding it back. But as to this court's question, if there was question about it and thought that maybe the right analysis wasn't done, I think the appropriate remedy would be to remand it back to Judge Hain and say, did you mean what you said when you the court clerk type restitution and the warrant of commitment? And they could apply whatever analysis is necessary. But I think as in Kujak, the court could simply affirm that portion of the district court's order for the disbursement.
Well, we're on this issue, and I know you wanted to leave it quickly, but can you educate us about what is the typical or proper procedure in most cases for the state to recover those kinds of expenses?
This was the precise procedure we typically follow. The only variant is that the prosecutor and sort of just casually referred to it inaccurately as restitution.
As a restitution affidavit, I think.
They called it a restitution affidavit, which it's not.
But it's just a letter.
That's just a letter. Yeah, it cites the statute. They should have called it distribution or prosecution cost. It's just a nomenclature. As this court called it, a simply an inadvertent technical error.
And then in the typical case, does the district court insert that into the warrant of commitment as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And is there anything? Okay. Thank you.
As to the aspect of the prosecutor's closing argument, I briefed that extensively, and I don't want to go down the details, but I would urge this court to give a very careful reading to the Mayhorn case. To state it colloquially, that case was a dumpster fire of various prosecutorial mistakes. And the we statement aspect of Mayhorn was just a small fraction of other things going on in Mayhorn. The were they lying statements, the prosecutor making reference to evidence that wasn't supposed to come in, the cross-examination of the defendant that was teeming with racial overtones. The prosecutor repeatedly in cross-examining the defendant talked about his baby mamas. Mr. Mayhorn was African-American, made reference to him hanging around with white girls at the mall. So again, I think if you read Mayhorn in full context, the aspects of the we, the us and them, was in the context with these other impermissible racial overtones and how it separated what I gathered to be a predominantly or all white jury from Mr. Mayhorn. And that's just not our case here. And I think the court can take into context the totality of the prosecutor's argument and find that, you know, were there some word choices that were improper, perhaps? As I refer to it, overly familiar? I think so. But this is not an occasion where the prosecutor is trying to deny the defendant a fair trial. Maybe the prosecutor was, you know, again, unduly familiar in the nature of their argument. But most of these we statements did make reference to evidence. Some of them were comments on the law itself. We, meaning the judicial system, why do we not allow certain things to happen? You know, so again, I've briefed that, and I in light of the court's questions, I think there's, I don't think I want to talk about that any further unless the court has questions.
Well, one quick question. I guess your opposing counsel has summarized or quantified it by saying approximately 10 of the 37 instances are usages that you would concede as being not totally, either possibly misconduct or not perfectly appropriate. Is that a fair summary of the evidence or of the record?
I don't have the number off the top of my head, right, but I tried to be as complete as I could in my brief, and I tried to make concessions where I felt I needed to. And in fact, I think I erred on the side of caution, and I'll leave that to this court to decide. I think I tried to find every occasion where there was a specific complaint and address it. Some were fine. I felt some I thought could have been a better word choice. My pitch, I think, overall is that when you take it into the totality of the circumstances and look at the argument overall, it just doesn't give rise to relief. You know, this is a popular argument. Now with a computer, we can scan for the word we. We see this all the time. This is a very popular argument. You highlight every time the prosecutor says we.
So, counsel, just if you don't mind, I don't mean to interrupt you. You can keep going on that line if you'd like. It's just, it seems to me that what you're arguing is we've gotten better tools to examine the transcript. And that seems to me to go to appellant's argument that this happens, this meaning prosecutorial misconduct, happens repeatedly in Olmsted County. And perhaps for if we get to the final prong, we decide that based on the integrity of the system, there needs to be a comment from this court. So would you address that argument?
Well, I can't argue with the notion of, you know, general accountability. I guess I take a little issue with signaling Olmsted County as a prolific offender compared to the rest of the state of Minnesota.
I guess maybe it's throughout the state of Minnesota. I don't take counsel's argument as saying only Olmsted County, but perhaps it is a pervasive problem. So
well, I think that's a question for this court to decide. I don't sure.
You're not going to comment on it?
I don't know that I have the basis to give a perspective statewide on that.
Then you can certainly talk about Olmsted County because sure. I'm sure you have that.
Certainly, and the issue has come up in Olmsted County, yeah. But I watch the decisions come out every week too, and I see this issue all over. So I don't know that it's, in other words, I don't know that certain corrective action needs to be laser focused on Olmsted County to teach, you know, Olmsted County a lesson because it's pervasive here. I guess I disagree with that when I guess anecdotally look at this issue more broadly. Portillo is, I think, inapplicable. That's where the prosecutor said the defendant no longer has the presumption of innocence. That's just a different issue altogether. There was relief granted there, but for different reasons. What I'd like to talk about is State v. Ness and what the Supreme Court called the unique facts in State versus Ness and why it is an outlier in cases like this. Paul Ness was a retired elementary school teacher who'd worked as a principal, and he was teaching community education art classes. And this class was from 9 to 3. There were a number of students, including EM, an 11-year-old boy, another teenage girl, and then the rest were adults. One of the adults was a teacher herself, a former student of Ness named Valerie Voigt. And Ms. Voigt, while attending the class, observed at 6 instances that she described in her testimony where Ness touched this boy what she felt to be inappropriately. She described some instances where his hand would reach around to the front of EM, and while she couldn't exactly see his hand, she testified that it was right around where his groin would be, and that was her perception that he was touching the child's private parts there. She was so concerned that she eventually got up and would intervene. She would stand next to Ness when he was helping EM with his painting project. And when the class was over and Ness left the room, she and another adult spoke to EM and asked if he'd been touched inappropriately. And EM said he had. Valerie Voigt wrote a note with her phone number, gave it to the boy and said, "Tell your mother and have her call me," which she did that very night after EM disclosed. The police were called immediately and this case proceeded. That's an unusual set of facts. When you have an independent eyewitness that observes virtually the entire incident. So there was no claim about fabrication here. The actual words in the Supreme Court said Valerie Voigt's remarkable corroborative testimony significantly supported EM's account. And the district court found her testimony credible in and of itself, suggesting that might have proven the case even without EM's testimony. The state's case was strong overall, and especially so with regard to dispelling any sense that EM fabricated the incident with Ness. The Spriegel evidence in the Ness case was 35 years old. It was another former student of Ness's, a fellow named Jeff Karen, who talked about 2 instances where he alleged that Ness had touched him inappropriately in the principal's office when he was a principal. And this court ruled that the evidence to be admissible, but the Supreme Court reversed that and found it was inadmissible. And a large part of that analysis dealt with the staleness of the 35-year-old Spriegel evidence, coupled with the fact that there was no fabrication questions here. There was no dispute as to who did the touching, where it occurred, when it occurred, and pretty much what occurred. But that's not our case here. And that's not the cases of Vermeerskirchen, Kennedy, where they very clearly pointed out the fact that the res gestae, the corpus delicti, the elements themselves can be the subject of Spriegel evidence, because typically child sexual abuse has no witnesses other than a small child. And that was the theme here. Whether it was fabrication, as Mr. Gonzalez stated in his sentencing, that this was totally fabricated, this was a lie, or alternatively, whether it was, well, you know, the child may have been sexually abused, but it could have been any one of a number of men that floated in and out of this family circle here. That was clearly at issue here, unlike Ness. And so while the Supreme Court ultimately found that Spriegel evidence inadmissible in Ness, I think it's a factual outlier from this case and many like it. The Spriegel evidence in this case, unlike Ness, involved the victim's sister, BG, who described that around the same time frame, in the same household, same location, that the defendant offered her a dollar if he could see her private parts or touch her private parts. Remarkably similar to the victim, LG's testimony that the defendant had placed a dollar by her pillow after sexually abusing her. In fact, it was that instance that brought LG to disclose this to her mother in the first place, taking the dollar to her mother, disclosing the abuse, which temporarily caused Gonzalez to leave the home. So when you consider the striking similarity to the behavior, the temporal connection, the location connection, I think this is precisely the sort of evidence that's permissible under 404B under our Spriegel analysis. So I think that's a topic worth, you know, real consideration and guidance from this court, not only as it bears on this case, but as we, you know, cite to this, to Ness in similar cases in the future. So unless the court has any further questions for me, I would conclude my remarks with that and just respectfully ask the court to affirm the conviction.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Haas.
Thank you.
Ms. Wales, you have an opportunity for a rebuttal argument. Please wait while we reset the clock.
Sure.
.456 is close enough. Okay. You may begin.
Thank you. I'll just make one comment related to the Spriegel issue. Actually, I'll make a couple comments related to the Spriegel issue. Just related to the point of fabrication and where this court should focus. This court needs to focus on the reasons that the district court gave for admitting the other bad acts evidence. And the fabrication comment that the defendant made at sentencing, that's not that type of allocution is not something that is a reason for admitting the evidence. That was at sentencing, obviously, after he had been found guilty. The respondent also seemed to take issue with defense counsel calling throughout the trial the complaining witness, the alleged victim, which of course defense counsel has right to say she's not yet, he has not yet been convicted. So alleged victim, there's no issue with that, I think, related to Spriegel. The district court judge admitted the evidence based on a time, general location, intent, and modus operandi. And so that's where this court should look, not on any reasons now posited by respondent as far as why that evidence should come in.
Am I correct that in the district court, the state identified, or excuse me, poor way to say it, the state said that identity which is one of the exceptions in 404B, was a purpose for the one of was either the purpose or one of the purposes for the evidence?
Yes, the state in its notice listed the common scheme or plan and identity.
And I think that's argued on appeal as well. So may we consider that as a whether the evidence is admissible for that purpose?
Well, no, I think that this court needs to only consider the reasons cited by the district court, and that's within case law cited in my brief, the district court's reasons, which were intent, modus operandi, and as I mentioned, time, general location.
What about the Grunig principle, where the respondent may make arguments for alternative, for affirming on alternative grounds in certain circumstances? Does that apply here?
No, I don't think that would apply here. Apologize that I left my brief at council table, but the district court had the chance to consider that and listed these four reasons that it listed. And so that's the reasons cited by the district court are those that this court should consider. So we would stick with those four reasons.
Do you believe or do you concede that the phrase common scheme and or plan is that part of the rule? In other words, is that a purpose that is within the scope of 404B?
Common scheme or plan and modus operandi, I believe, kind of fit together. And so, yes, I think that comes into it. I think, as the court stated, the modus operandi is proper for consideration, and I don't see a big difference between in this situation between those two phrases. If I'm understanding your question correctly,
there's a child victim in the Spiegel and the dollar bill. I mean, why is that not modus operandi, common scheme or plan?
I think that the acts alleged themselves is more indicative of what the plan is really. The Spiegel was offering, just asking, kind of voice only, no touching of the child, no grabbing, offering a dollar to see her genitals. The act for which he was convicted was involved touching, kind of taking or pulling her away from the house, and then physical touching of her, sexual contact of her genitals. So I think that those two acts are quite different. And when with the Spiegel evidence, when the girl said no, then he left. There was no follow-up. There was no kind of a threat or as there was alleged in the main act for which he was convicted.
If you have more rebuttal points, feel free to quickly touch on them, even though the.
Thank you. The only thing I'll mention is adequately, I think, argued about the misconduct. Just on the point of Olmsted County versus the entire state, this case is based in Olmsted County. In my research, there was an Olmsted County case that I found quite recently from April. I know that there's one pending in my office as well, so that's why I do focus on what comes out of this county. Certainly, we are concerned about the statewide pervasiveness as well. And if there is more technological ability to find improper statements, I think that's a good thing. It's not something that I happen to use in this case, but I don't think that that's something that we should complain about. We should be glad about that if that's the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.